The Church of God the Eternal presents the 29th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, June 20th, 2026.
We're going to tackle another message in this long series on the survey of the books of Samuel. This will be the 29th message in the series, and I've been able to reconnect it up with the chapters as well, which means we're also going to cover chapter 29 in installment 29. So I kind of feel on track. If you remember, last time we covered actually two chapters, 27 and 28. Where we found in summary that David and his 600 warriors took refuge from King Saul in the Philistine territory in the city of Gath with King Achish, and was given an entire town named Ziklag, about 25 miles south of Gath. So David came in, the Philistine king was favorable toward David and his men, allowed them to make their abode with all of their families in Philistine territory, and in fact gave them their own walled town. So, and as I pointed out to you, David is now coming in with a lot of deception involved in it, because he's got his own agenda now. He's going on offense, as we found out, rather than 8 to 10 years of playing defense, basically running from Saul. He's now actually changing his approach. And so we find that then David immediately with his men started raiding nomadic civilizations and peoples to the south. So not those in the Philistine territory, but also not in the Israelite territory of Judah either. But he lied to the Philistine king when the king asked him, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm raiding in the Jewish territory. In other words, and the king didn't verify, didn't have a spy network, took David's word for it, believed David's being honest with him, which he's not. And basically, the king thinks David has burned his bridges in Israel, which is why he has extra confidence that David truly is now on his side, even though David hasn't. You know, in this entire storyline that we've gone through, David has not attacked any Israelites. And I don't know that I've made that point, but looking back now from all the chapters we've covered, look at the history of what has happened. And obviously he's being chased by Saul and his army. But David has always run. He's never turned and actually fought against Saul or the Israelites, let alone the examples we've seen where David had Saul in his grasp and could have killed him and chose not to do it. But he's also not fought against any of his fellow Israelites, either of Judah or of any of the other tribes, which is pretty phenomenal. So that is the best baseline to tell you what is in David's mind, regardless of whether the account that God inspired spells out what's happening and what he's thinking or not. Keep that in mind, because his past actions are telling you what he cares about and what he's really doing, regardless of what he's saying to the Philistines out loud. So we find that the five kings of Philistia assembled and combined a great army from all five portions of the Philistine nation to attack Israel in the north, in the valley of Jezreel, a strategic trade route in the north. Saul now responds to this in a panic, seeking God's help, and God won't talk to him. There's no prophet. He's killed all the prophets, except for the one, Abiathar, who got away and is now aligned with David. So he has no prophets to intercede with him with God. So he turns to the witch of Endor. And we saw that entire account at the end of chapter 28, where he now buys into this idea of being able to talk to the dead. A demon helps him by impersonating the dead Samuel, but tells him the truth, that in spite of what Saul hoped to hear, which is that there's a means for him and the Israelites to escape the wrath of the Philistines, it's not going to happen. In fact, the demon prophesies that Saul and his sons are going to die. So that's where we left off. at the end of chapter 28. Now we get into chapter 29, and the question is David actually going to fight on the side of the Philistines against his own people? We will find out here. Chapter 29, beginning in verse 1, "Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel." So where is this? I tried to give you a little bit of geography. I don't want to, you know, dwell on it too much. But the city of Aphek was a strategic fortress town on the northern edge of the Philistine territory. So this wasn't on Israel's side of the border. It was on the Philistine side. Now, wait a minute, because in chapter 28, we read that the Philistines had already moved into Israelite territory in the north, on the northern edge of this great valley of Jezreel. But now it's saying they're all on the Philistine side. So what gives? What this is really doing is it's one of those many places in the Bible where God does you a rewind and shows you in one place, he shows you a certain storyline, and then he goes back and shows you a different storyline that actually happened prior to. And that's the best way to make this make sense. So really, this city on the Philistine side of the border was a mustering point for all the five different armies of the five Philistine kings. So they didn't decide to muster in hostile territory. It makes sense. They literally all came together from across the entire nation on their side of the border. And then they advanced to Shunem, which was what we read in chapter 28 now, which is in Israelite territory, setting their array for the battle to come. So that's the best way to understand it. And it said, "And the Israelites pitched by a fountain, which is in Jezreel." All right, so that's still 28 told us Mount Gilboa, which is on the south side of the Jezreel Valley, a high mountain in Israel. Saul is now setting up his Israelite defenders in the high country across from the invaders. All right. So, and supposedly this is talking about a fountain, which the commentators think was a spring called the Spring of Herod. It's a guesswork because there is such a spring literally at the base of Mount Gilboa. All right, verse 2, "And the lords of the Philistines passed on by hundreds and by thousands. But David and his men passed on in the rearward with Achish." Okay, so remember, we found out before that this king of Gath trusts David so much, he's even appointed David and his army as his personal royal guard, which means he wants them to stay close to him in any battle. In case they become under serious threat, then David's men are his fallback to protect him. That's how much he trusts him. All right, so they've mustered now and are getting ready to march to the battle site, which we read from the previous chapter. But now something else is going to happen. Verse 3, "Then said the princes of the Philistines." So they all come together with their armies. It's their first meeting, if you will. "The princes of the Philistines said, 'What do these Hebrews here? What are these Israelites doing here?' So apparently they did not know before they all came together to combine their forces that Achish is actually harboring 600 of these enemy Israelite soldiers as a part of his cohort. "And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, 'Is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, which hath been with me these days or these years?'" And remember, we also saw that he was a total time, for he, his army, and all of their families was 1 year and 4 months, actually living among the Philistines. He says, "which have been with me these days or these years, and I have found no fault in him since he fell unto me unto this day." And the princes of the Philistines were wroth with him. They were mad at their fellow king. They weren't having this, and they didn't believe it. "And the princes of the Philistines said unto him, 'Make this fellow return, that he may go again to his place, which thou hast appointed him.'" Meaning, okay, you gave him a town to live in Ziklag, send him and his 600 soldiers back. We don't want him on this campaign. Make this fellow return that he may go again to the place which thou hast appointed him, and let him not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us. For wherewith should he reconcile himself unto his master? They're saying, what if he actually reconciles with King Saul and then turns on us, and he's right there with all of his soldiers in the midst of our army? And they're saying this would be foolish to trust David. Should it not be with the heads of these men? And now we're making reference not only to David himself and his intent, but also the character and the motivation of these soldiers under David. We're going to spend now, there's only 11 verses in this chapter, and if you think that's so, we're going to speed through chapter 29 and go right into verse 30, think again. Because, and I was planning on doing that until I actually started putting my notes together. And then I found out there's actually some really important parallel accounts that affect everything that's going on right here in the book of 1 Chronicles. So we're going to get through chapter 29, but I'm going to read quite a bit in 1 Chronicles in chapter 11 and 12 as well. So just bear in mind. And it has to do with the actual personalities of these men in the army of David. And the Philistines seem to have known some of it, because these were actually men who had reputations themselves of exploits. Not just David. He was maybe the greatest, but these other men did. And you don't see that in all the accounts that we've read up till now. The book of 1 Samuel is not really focused upon that. But 1 Chronicles has a lot more about these characters, which I think is really going to help fill out the storyline to give you more insights. Verse 5, they said, is not this David of whom they sang one to another in dances, saying, Saul slew his thousands and David his 10,000s? The Philistines heard those stories just as much as the Israelites did. And remember that the first time that happened was what turned Saul in envy and jealousy against David, when he heard the people singing that very chorus. Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. Well, who were the thousands and 10,000s that were dying to make David such a great hero? The Philistines. And these Philistine kings are very aware of it. And yes, that happened probably 8, maybe even up to 10 years prior to this event. And a lot of things can change in 8 to 10 years. And Achish absolutely believes that everything has changed in David's motivation since then, and that now he's truly changed allegiance against Saul. The other kings are going, we don't believe it. We don't believe that leopard has changed his spots. And who are the wise ones, these other four kings? They've got it exactly right. Achish is actually the fool for trusting David. These other four Philistine kings have it exactly right, that David is not to be trusted. All right, now we find that Achish is going to have to tell David the bad news, because in essence, these kings, you know, the king of Gath doesn't get to make the rules for everyone else. They're all little kings over their own domains in the greater nation of Philistia, but they all have to work together, almost like if you say they have to vote or agree. Well, Achish was outvoted, so he has no choice but to send David and his men back. All right, verse 6, then Achish called David and said unto him, surely as the eternal liveth, which I think is fascinating. He's actually swearing by the name of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, not by one of his pagan gods, which is pretty amazing. He said unto him, surely as the eternal liveth, thou hast been upright, and thy going out and thy coming in with me in the host is good in my sight. Achish is saying, David, I know this year and 4 months that you have been in my territory, you have not done anything wrong to me. You have kept your word. You have showed yourself to be honorable. If he only knew. No, he hasn't done anything against the Philistines, let alone against the king of Gath. But he's absolutely been lying to this king because of all his exploits in going after the Amalekites and others. I have not found evil in thee since the day of thy coming unto me unto this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's favor thee not. But these other kings, I can't ignore, and they don't trust you. Verse 7, wherefore now return and go in peace, that thou displease not the lords of the Philistines. So if this great amalgamated army of the Philistines is going to go forward to have a chance to fight against Israel, let alone defeat them, they all need to be on the same page. So Achish knows if he insists on keeping David and his 600 warriors, the whole alliance is going to, these other kings will take their men and go home. It's not going to happen if David is a part of it. So Achish has no choice, regardless of how he feels. Verse 8, and David said unto Achish, okay, I understand. No, David's still working his angle. Again, what was his angle? He wanted to go to battle with the Philistines. But again, I ask you the question, do you really think David had the intention of fighting on the side of the Philistines and killing Israelites? That was not ever in his mind. And again, I point back to the history of everything he's done for the last 8 to 10 years. That's the best proof. If he didn't do it then, he's not changed his mind. So what was he doing? He was playing a game with the Philistines, hoping they would let him and his men go to battle on their side. And what was he going to do? He was going to turn on them and wipe them out. It's not said there, but you can connect the dots and be assured that's exactly what David intended. So he wanted to go. He wanted to march with this combined army into the valley of Jezreel and set up an array against the Israelites. But now he's being turned away. He's not willing to give up. Verse 8, David said unto Achish, but what have I done? And what hast thou found in thy servant so long as I have been with thee unto this day, that I may not go fight against the enemies of my lord king? Well, Achish has already said he's found nothing wrong with him. As far as he knows, he's been very honorable. But David's still pleading. Verse 9, and Achish answered and said unto David, I know that thou art good in my sight, as an angel of God. That's how deceived he is. I know that you are good in my sight, as an angel of God. Notwithstanding, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. They've put their foot down. They simply won't have it. So Achish is being outvoted. Verse 10, wherefore, he says to David, rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants. Oh, we got to talk. Who is this? Let me finish. Rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants that are come with thee. And as soon as you be up early in the morning and have light, depart. You got to get out of here. You got to vacate and go home. What master? Wherefore he said, now rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants. Because right now, ostensibly, the king of Gath is David's master. And Achish is not talking about himself. So who's this master of David he's talking about? He's talking about Saul. In other words, it's still the fact that David is an Israelite. And David's king is Saul. And that's how the other Philistine kings are treating it. He's saying, your master, previously, even if Achish thinks he's really changed allegiances, but here he literally calls David's master is Saul. Which also fills in the gap of who else is he talking about. He says, rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants. Who, if Saul is the master, who are Saul's servants that are with David? Former high-ranking military soldiers and officers who have come over from Saul's army now to follow David. Now, can we substantiate that that was happening? Oh, yeah, and that's why we're going to go into the book of 1 Chronicles to fill in the gaps. But this is not just a pie-in-the-sky interpretation here of verse 10. Because I'm absolutely going to support this by parallel accounts. So Achish is aware, not only in the past, and really this movement of Israelite soldiers who have been defecting from Saul's and coming over to David's side. And this has been going on for 8 to 10 years. But there appears to have been even a last-minute rush coming out, as I'm going to show you, of the tribe of Manasseh. And they're probably referring to the fact that there are new Israelite defectors that are now part of David. And the Philistines are looking at it and saying, are we really going to trust these guys? They had every reason to say, we don't trust them at all. Rise up early in the morning with thy master's servants that are come with thee. And as soon as you be up early in the morning and have light, depart. Okay. Let's go to 1 Chronicles chapter 12. I'm going to go through some in chapter 12, and then we'll back up to chapter 11, where it's even got some more detail. Here, this is like an inset. If you want to say we're going to like go back in time now and look at some more detailed description of the characters that make up the army of David. 1 Chronicles 12, beginning in verse 1. Now these are they that came to David to Ziklag. Okay, so now the first. Now there's ones, and it gets confusing about knowing which soldiers came at what time frame years ago when David first went on the run versus ones that came later. And we'll try to make sense of that. But to begin with, we're talking about the ones that seems to have come after David was already running for at least 8 years. And now he goes to Gath, is domiciled by King Achish and given Ziklag. Now you've got this particular group of soldiers from Israel, which came while David was already abiding with his soldiers and their families in Philistine territory. These are they that came to David to Ziklag, while he yet kept himself close because of Saul, the son of Kish, and they were among the mighty men, helpers of the war, which is kind of an interesting term in Old English, but it just means skilled warriors. Helpers of the war is a way of saying your best fighting men that actually help you win wars. That's what the inference is. They are among the mighty men, helpers of the war, verse 2. They were armed with bows and could use both the right hand and the left in hurling stones and shooting arrows out of a bow, even of Saul's brethren of Benjamin. What is most remarkable is a big part or a significant part of the skilled soldiers actually came out of Saul's own tribe of Benjamin. Remember, David was of the tribe of Judah. Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin. And yet, David had such a reputation and such a following that a number of, and not just the dregs of Saul's army, of the Benjamites. These weren't the ones who were passed over for promotion and were kind of expendable and they were disgruntled and decided to come over to David. These are some of the best warriors in Saul's army, even of his own tribe. And they have come over to David. Remember, it was the Benjamites that were left-handed, or even many of them appears were ambidextrous, which means they could fight equally as well with either hand. How valuable is that? And that's what's being described here. Armed with bows and could use both the right hand and the left in hurling stone. How many of you can throw well with your offhand? I would look like a girl if I tried to throw with my left, and I'll get in trouble for saying that, but... But you can throw, I mean, if you've thrown baseballs, whatever it is, and you feel pretty good about throwing with your dominant hand, put that ball in the other hand and try it. So think about how skilled you would be if you were equally able to use your left or your right, and how valuable that would make you as a soldier. Really, to be able to use a bow in either hand? Can you shoot a bow? Probably a number of you have practiced archery. Try it with your offhand. Change hands and see how well you can shoot. That's what these guys could do. How significant is that skill? Even of Saul's brethren, Benjamin, in verse 3, the chief with, I'm going to try not to dwell a lot on, this. Chronicles has got a whole list of names. And my focus is not going to be on all the names, just the key. I want to focus on certain ones that have storylines behind it, not just names that mean nothing to us in particular. The chief was Ahazer, then Joash, sons of Shema, of the Gibeathite. So remember this particular Shema. If he is a Gibeathite, remember Gibeah is the hometown of Saul. Gibeah is the place where Saul's castle or fortress is from where he rules. So again, you're talking about soldiers that have come right out of the heart of Saul's army. And Jeziel and Pelet, sons of Osmatheth, and Barakah, and Jehu, and the Antonite. Okay, verse 4, and Ismaiah, the Gibeonite, a mighty man among the 30 and over the 30. All right, we don't have a whole lot of insight, but these are basically references to the elite leaders in the army. And this was talking about the army of Saul, who have now transferred over their allegiance to David. So within David, so he started off with a few hundred. It's risen now over time to 600. All right, and of these 600, now are these just the bedraggled cast-offs of Saul's armies? Not at all. Actually, David ended up with the cream of the crop of the ones that chose to follow him over in a protracted period of time of 8 to 10 years. So now we find this particular Gibeonite called a mighty man among the 30. So there is a special classification of it's like the top 30 leaders. And he was mighty among the 30 over the 30. So he was one of the highest generals under David, if you will. I'm not going to read the rest of that in verse 4, 5, 6, and 7. But just understand that this was David's core group of elite warriors. They're described in more detail, and we're going to read that description in a little bit, not quite yet, in Chronicles 11, parts of verses 10 through 47. So you can go through and read it more in detail with more descriptions about these particular men. It's also 2 Samuel 23, 8 through 39. We're going to get to that when we get into 2 Samuel. I'm not going to divert and go over and read more because we will get to that. And then we'll do a bit of a refresher when we get that far into 2 Samuel. But for now, just understand that these were renowned for extraordinary bravery and feats in battle, including fighting overwhelming odds, defending key positions, and achieving high kill counts, which I am going to show you. That's not just supposition. All right, continuing in 1 Chronicles 12, drop down to verse 8. And the Gadites there separated themselves unto David into the hold. Okay, now what are we talking about? All right, well, who are the Gadites? Well, Gad was the tribe, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, but remember, where was their territory? Remember, there were 2.5 tribes when the children of Israel first came into the promised land who wanted to stay on the east side of the Jordan River. Remember, they asked for their inheritance to be on the east side, not to come in across the Jordan with all the rest of the tribes. And remember, Joshua, with God's instruction, said, fine, but you can't just abandon our army because you're already in your, dwelling place for your families. You've got to commit to continuing to follow us across the Jordan and help us fight against the Canaanites so that we get our inheritance, and then you can go home on the east side of the Jordan River. So the Gadites were one of the full tribes. Remember, it was Reuben, it was Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh, who actually took their homeland on the east side of the Jordan River. So here are these Gadites, after David was basically expelled and turned into an enemy by Saul, and these soldiers of Gad on the east side of the river came in to David's army. When did this happen? Right at the beginning. How do we know that? Because it says David was in the hold. What's that talking about? It's talking about the cave of Adullam. When did that happen, when David fled and ended up in this cave of Adullam? Remember, the first 400 soldiers all came into him, and including his parents. Remember, because his parents were in danger of being wiped out by Saul. They all flee. When David had to flee, anybody associated with David had to flee. But then all of these soldiers from Gad came in. So if you go back and connect the dots earlier in the chapter where we read about him gaining an army of 400, now we find that these Gadites were a part of that 400. And what was significant about them? The Gadites there separated themselves into David into the hold to the wilderness, men of might and men of war fit for the battle that could handle shield and buckler, whose faces were like the faces of lions and were as swift as the rose upon the mountain. Were these men you would like to have in your army? Oh, yeah. These were the best, the cream of the crop that came out of the tribe of Gad. They were ostensibly a part of Saul's greater Israelite army, but they immediately and early on sided with David. What else did they do? Now drop down, I'm not going to read all the names. Verse 14, these were the sons of Gad, captains of the host. They weren't just low-level soldiers. These were the captains. These were the high-ranking officers. One of the least was over 100. Of these Gadites that came over to David, the lowest level of them was basically a captain over 100 men. And the greatest, over 1,000. These were the top. 15, these are they that went over Jordan in the first month when it had overflown all his banks, and they put to flight all them of the valleys, both toward the east and toward the west. This gives you something we haven't found anywhere else. When these men decided to follow David and to come and help him and to side with him, they had to come from their homeland on the east side of the Jordan River at the worst time of the season when the Jordan River was in flood stage. It's very difficult to cross that river at all. And these elite soldiers did so at the flood stage at risk to themselves. They could have easily drowned. Now that's how strong these men were. Literally, at the most perilous time, crossed the river and came to David's aid when he was hiding in the cave. So this is way back. We're talking from the time period we're talking about with David now in Ziklag. We're talking 8 to 10 years prior to that. This is going way back. Verse 16. And there came of the children of Benjamin and Judah to the hold. Now we're talking about other Benjamites and soldiers from the tribe of Judah who came early on, not like these ones that were described as coming after David was already in Ziklag. Now see, this is flashing back to these 400 original soldiers and a little bit more information about who they were. There came of the children of Benjamin and Judah to the hold unto David, meaning to that cave. And David went out to meet them. Here's a storyline. Now, I could have covered this. I mean, I could have diverted from when we covered David in the cave and 400 soldiers came in. I could have gone over here and I didn't do it. But I think to get this all now in sequence and showing the whole history of these personalities makes sense at this point. Verse 17, David went out to meet them. Okay, here are these soldiers showing up. He doesn't know who they are, and he certainly doesn't trust them. Well, he did know them personally. And remember, David had been a general under Saul and doing great exploits after he defeated Goliath. So was that a 1 to 2 year period? Again, it doesn't say, and we've speculated what that might have been. If he was 16 and then was in Saul's army till 18, or if he was 18 when he killed Goliath up until he was 20, whatever it is. He's somewhere between 16 and 18 years old and went out and immediately, I'm not going to go back and rehearse those things we covered before that said, he made a hero out of himself with the Israelites because of his exploits on the battlefield. So ostensibly, this is a lot of those soldiers who were in Saul's army, but under young David's control, who came to respect him and to trust him. And now that he's on the run from Saul, they're all flocking to him. That's how much respect David had gained from not just the low levels of Saul's army. You're talking about the elites in Saul's army. These are the men who are coming over to David. So David goes out, but here are all these soldiers come from Gad, from across the Jordan River. David goes out to meet them and answered and said unto them, "If you be come peaceably unto me to help me, mine heart shall be knit unto you. If you're coming as a friend, I am overjoyed to see you. But if you be come to betray me to mine enemy," meaning Saul, "seeing there is no wrong in my hands," I didn't do anything to threaten Saul, "but if you've come now to support Saul against me, the God of our fathers look thereon and rebuke it." He's not saying, "I'm going to kill you," but he is invoking the name of God and saying, "If you've come in order to undermine me on Saul's behalf," he says, "basically, I'm calling you out and asking God to strike you down." That's pretty interesting. So how many of us would be able to do that? And people would look at us and laugh. Yeah, right. Apparently, David had the cred in order to be able to make that kind of a bold statement. And these soldiers believed it. What would you say against a young boy that killed the greatest giant of the Philistines with a stone from a sling? Do you think they thought God was on his side? They had not forgotten. So David is saying, "Okay, I hope you're a friend, but if you're not, I'm going to call God to defend me against you." Verse 18, "Then the Spirit came upon Amasai." Now you have the name of one of these generals, in essence, of the tribe of Gad, who was chief of the captains. And he said, speaking for all of these, "Thine are we, David, and on thy side, thou son of Jesse. Peace, peace be unto thee, and peace be to thine helpers, for thy God helps thee." He's acknowledging, "We believe God is on your side, David. The reason we're here is we absolutely believe God is on your side, not on Saul's." Then David received them and made them captains of the band. So all this ragtag army, 400 original soldiers, which is coming together on the run in the wilderness in this cave. And here are these elite, the highest level leaders, captains and generals that are coming over to David. He accepts them, and in fact, they become the leaders of David's army. Verse 19, "And there fell some," and when it says fell, a lot of times in the Bible, it's talking about falling in battle, being killed. That's not the reference here. It's talking about coming over, siding with. "There fell some of Manasseh to David." So we've talked about the Gadites. We've talked about those from Judah, from the tribe of Benjamin. And now, here's a whole cadre that's coming over from the tribe and the other tribe of the north. Now, it doesn't say whether these Manassites are from the half-tribe that also was on the east side of the Jordan, or if now they're the Manassites that are on to the north, on the west side of the Jordan. But anyway, it's a whole cadre of Manassites in the mix as well. "There fell some of Manasseh to David when he came with the Philistines against Saul to battle. But they helped them not, for the lords of the Philistines upon advisement sent him away, saying, 'He will fall to his master Saul to the jeopardy of our heads.'" Now, who are these? Fast forward 8 to 10 years, we're talking about the very last time frame that we just talked about in chapter 29. So we had the account of the ones who came with David early and have been fighting with him now for 8 to 10 years. And now you've got this group of elite soldiers from Saul's army and Manasseh, which came late in the game. This is where you fill in the gap. Another reason why these other Philistine lords did not believe David or accept him or trust him. Because you've got all these very elite Manassites that are coming over in the 11th hour and now claiming to support David and are going to fight with the Philistines. And they said, "Nah, we don't trust it at all." So that these are those men that were referred to when Achish said to David, "Your master's servants," meaning Saul's soldiers who are now changing sides. lines up very well with these Manassites that it says came over late in the game. For the Lord of the Philistines, upon advisement, sent him away, saying he will fall to his master Saul, meaning he will change allegiance again and side with Saul to the jeopardy of our heads. All right. So these are late defectors, if you will, from Saul's army, soon before the great battle. Now, if he had 600 before, and it's still, the question I have about it is because when we get into chapter 30, which we're not going to do today, 1 Samuel, it's still counting David's army like 600. And yet you've had these new recruits, if you will, that have come over. I don't know what the real count was, because they were still amassing behind David. It was not a static thing at all. The Philistines wisely knew that these defectors were not to be trusted by the Philistines. All right, verse 20, still here in 1 Chronicles 12. And he went to Ziklag. As he went to Ziklag, there fell to him of Manasseh, meaning came over from the Israelite side over to David, of Manasseh, Adnah and Jozabad and Jediel and Michael and Jozabad and Elihu and Zilthai, captains of the thousands that were of Manasseh. Again, we've seen it's the elite leaders of the armies, the men of renown, mighty warriors that have come from the other tribes. What about these Manassites that came over? They were also the cream of the crop of Saul's army that came over to David. Now, I wonder, when Saul took his army and went up to array themselves against this huge Philistine attack that was looming in the valley of Jezreel, were some of his greatest generals defecting and going over to David? Could that have been another reason that Saul was so panicked? Not only the size of this Philistine army that outnumbered him so greatly, but the fact that his own men were deserting him and going to David in the land of the Philistines. Don't know, but if I think it's possible maybe to connect the dots that way. So here are these men, also the cream of the crop of the army of Saul, who came from the tribe of Manasseh. Verse 21, and they helped David against the band of the rovers. Ah, we haven't gotten to that storyline yet. That's going to be 1 Samuel chapter 30. So this is already stepping on the next material. We won't do that. But just understand, so they came in between the time that David was in Ziklag already with his existing army, leading up to the time that the Philistines were about to attack Saul in the valley of Jezreel. These Manassites, high-ranking Manassites, come over to David, but they're all sent away back to Ziklag. These new recruits of the Manassites are going to be with David's army in time for his next foray, which will come up in the next chapter. They helped David against the band of rovers, for they were all mighty men of valor and were captains of the host, the elite of the elite, that all came out of Saul's army. So it says they were leaders of units of 1,000 in Manasseh that we saw in verse 20, experienced commanders who eventually brought organized fighting men with them. Their defection at this late stage of the game, when Saul's defeat looked very likely, showed the momentum was shifting decisively toward David. Even from the tribes that had previously stayed loyal to Saul, they're shifting to David already. All right, now we're going to back up to 1 Chronicles 11. And why didn't I do it in order? Because you get more details that are interesting, I think, in chapter 11 that augment what we already saw in chapter 12. You'll be the judge. 1 Chronicles 11, I'm going to pick it up in verse 10. Now I'm going to read verses 10 through 26. But again, you can read more detail and kind of put more of the pieces together if you're interested in the greater storyline. 1 Chronicles 11, verse 10. These also are the chief of the mighty men whom David had, who strengthened themselves with him in his kingdom and with all Israel to make him king, according to the word of the Eternal concerning Israel. Now you're talking about an entire span. Men who came with him at some time early on while he was a fugitive from Saul, But this is now covering all the way into the period after Saul dies and David now begins to reign as a king, 7.5 years in Judah before becoming king over the entire nation of Israel. But this is a kind of a sweeping statement, which is talking about some of these key fighting men that have a role in the entire plan as God worked it out to give support and power to David. Verse 11, and this is the number of the mighty men whom David had. And now for the first time we read this name, Jashobeam, and Hakamite, or Hakmonite, the chief of the captains. This is like the top dog. Not even heard him referenced before. And yet this guy is the greatest among all of these great warriors on David's side. What does it mean that he's a Hakmonite? It just means he's from the family of Hakmon. That was his father. I kind of tried to look this up and put it together. Won't dwell on that. But he was a Benjamite. I'm not going to prove that to you, but there's other places in here that prove that this man, Jashobeam, was a Benjamite, again, out of Saul's family tribe. And he becomes the head general under David overall, the chief of the captains. He lifted up, and now what was his great exploit? What was his claim to fame as a courageous warrior? It says here, he lifted up his spear against 300 slain by him at one time. That almost sounds like, some of these exploits in the book of Judges, like with Samson, who killed, 1,000 with the jawbone of an ass. Here you've got this man who killed 300 men at one time. I mean, that's beyond belief. That's what it says. God recorded in the Bible. So this isn't just folklore where, people like human beings write stories and they make, a big deal and embellish. This has to be fact. It's part of the Bible. He lifted up his spear against 300 slain by him at one time. Do you think there's a reason that he was top dog in David's army? Do you think there's a reason why he had the respect of these elite warriors, even as David had respect as the leader? Yeah. Who else? Verse 12. And after him was Eleazar. Do not confuse this with Eleazar the Levite or any of the line of the priest. He is also a Benjamite. It's really fascinating to me that some of the elite soldiers came out of the tribe of Benjamin. I don't know. They had a knack for it. And again, because these are the ones that also had the physical acumen of being ambidextrous, could fight with both hands equally and do all these exploits, there was something special about these Benjamites. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Aholite, which is referring to Dodo's father, who was one of the three mighties. Okay, and now we've got a reference to three mighty men who are distinguished from everyone else. It's almost like the top three generals. Verse 13, he was with David at Pas Damim. And there the Philistines were gathered together to battle, where was a parcel of ground full of barley. And the people fled from before the Philistines. Like, when did this happen? All right, some of the scholars disagree. Did this happen early on, years before? Was it later? The one that makes most sense to me, that this is referring all the way back to the period of time, 1 to 2 years, when David was in Saul's favor, soon after killing Goliath, and now was put at the head of Saul's army, and went out and slaughtered hundreds of Philistines. That was part of the storyline that we read already, chapters ago. We didn't get any details about what David did, but remember, what was one of the things he did in order to earn the right to marry Michal? He slaughtered not 100, but 200 men and brought the foreskins of them as payment to Saul in order for the right to marry Michal. We didn't get any details about any of those battles. that took place. And yet here seems to be a little snippet of one of the details of one of those early battles. And here this man, Eleazar, also a Benjamite, and there the Philistines were gathered together to battle, where was a parcel of ground full of barley, and the people fled from before the Philistines. And I'm saying this is while David acted as Saul's general against the Philistines. Verse 14, and they set themselves in the midst of the parcel. David, with his band of mighty warriors, basically set themselves in the middle of a barley field and delivered it and slew the Philistines, and the internals saved them by a great deliverance. Wish we had more information. Would be a great storyline. But they literally, while everybody else was fleeing, they stood their ground and fought against a great army of the Philistines and defeated them. It was one of those events that gave credit to David as the general in charge of the army, but behind any great man are going to be warriors under him that are making that possible. Well, this man Eleazar, this Benjamite, was one of them. Verse 15. Now, three of the 30 captains went down to the rock to David into the cave of Adullam. So now this gives you a timeline. Of these ones apparently who were assigned under David, fought under David while they were all still with Saul. Once Saul started trying to kill David and David had to run, now some of these mightiest men in David's army followed him, including early on when he ran to the cave. Three of the 30 captains went down to the rock to David into the cave of Adullam. And likely these three, again, we've already seen a reference to the three. It's probably this head honcho, Joshubim, who was chief of the three, Eleazar, and there's a third one named Shammah, son of Agi. Well, wait a minute, where'd you get that? That wasn't anywhere here. You can find that in 2 Samuel 23, 11, and 12. I'm not going to turn to that again. We will get to that account when we get into the book of 2 Samuel. But I'm just telling you, that fills in some of the detail that of these three, it seems to be this Jashobeam, and Eleazar, and this other man named Shammah, S-H-A-M-M-A-H. These were the top generals. All right. And continuing on, it says here, and the host of the Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. So here's another exploit now in the early days of David. Verse 16, and David was then in the hold. What's the time frame? He's a fugitive on the run, but he's only recently started to run, and he's hiding in the cave of Adullam, where the first 400 soldiers and his family, by the way, gather around him. David was then in the hold, and the Philistines' garrison was then at Bethlehem. This is a new story. We didn't get this detail when we read the account in 1 Samuel. But now here's a snippet that expands on events that happened. Verse 17, and David longed and said, oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem that is at the gate. Remember, this cave of Adullam was in that borderland, that no man's land between the proper rulership of the Philistines in the west and the Israelites in the east. And David found this cave that was kind of in between them, trying to hide out. They weren't that far away from Bethlehem. Okay? And I didn't relook it up to see how many miles, but you're talking about that general area. So here's an exploit that happened while he was still hiding with these 400 soldiers and families in this borderland area. David longed and said, oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem that is at the gate. And what we're going to find out is that the Philistines had a garrison that were controlling Bethlehem. Wait a minute, but Bethlehem was in the Israelite side of the territory. But remember, there are a lot of times in this history where the Philistines, who were stronger than Israelites and basically had garrisons, they had small bands who were controlling fortified areas, even in the Israelite side that the Israelites couldn't do anything about or weren't doing anything about. So at this very time, they had encroached again. I mean, so what? David had defeated Goliath. The Israelites sent the Philistines running. They always creep back. And they always come in and then set up their little strongholds. Well, they had their stronghold in Bethlehem. And remember, this is right in the area where David lived. This was David's homeland in Judah. Why do you think he was making this statement? Oh, how I wish I could have a drink of water from the well in Bethlehem. It was probably a place where he used to get water. And he's just making this emotional lamentation because it's being controlled by the enemy. So David just says this off the cuff, and then what happens? And the three who? These three most courageous, mighty warrior leaders who have aligned with David. They heard him say it, and they just said, we're going to go get it. It doesn't matter that we're greatly outnumbered. Our leader says he wants a drink of water from the Bethlehem well. We're going to get it. Verse 18, the three break through the host of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and took it and brought it to David. He said, your wish is my command. This was audacious. And it gives us no more detail, but you can fill in the blanks yourself, especially because of what David said in reply to this act. David's telling you by his response of how absolutely dangerous and utterly foolhardy this was for them to go in there, three men against this garrison of Philistines. But David would not drink of it, but poured it out to the Eternal. In other words, he used this water from the Bethlehem well almost like a sacrifice to God. Why? Verse 19, and said, my God forbid it me that I should do this thing. Shall I drink the blood of these men that have put their lives in jeopardy? He's acknowledging that these three super warriors took their lives in their hand just because they heard David say he'd like a drink of water. And they went in there at peril to themselves. How many Philistines did they have to kill just to get to the well to get water and bring back? But David says, I'm not going to drink of it. Should I do this thing? Shall I drink the blood of these men that have put their lives in jeopardy? For with the jeopardy of their lives, they brought it. Therefore, he would not drink it. These things did these three mightiest. They're called the mightiest of David's army. Verse 20, and Abishai. Now, we've heard about Abishai before. This is not a new name. You remember who Abishai is? A nephew of David. Abishai, the brother of Joab, he was chief of the three, the oldest brother. So there are actually three brothers, as we're going to see. Abishai is the oldest of the three of David's older sister. So these are his nephews. We've already seen about some of their exploits earlier on. Abishai, the brother of Joab, he was chief of the three. Now, wait a minute. We've already seen the three being referred to like the highest ranking super warriors in David's army. But this is not, as you're going to see, the same three. It's probably referring just to the three brothers, the nephews of David. Abishai, the brother of Joab, he was chief of the three. Now, Joab would later become the most prominent because you're going to see Joab is going to be front and center in the book of 2 Samuel, for good and for bad. All right? He was the middle son. Abishai was the oldest, and he was the leader. Joab would ultimately become the supreme commander of the army of David, but not until later. Abishai, the brother of Joab, he was chief of the three for lifting up his spear. Now here's an exploit of Abishai himself. For lifting up his spear against 300, sounds very familiar. Lifting up his spear against 300, he slew them and had a name among the three. Meaning among the three brothers, the oldest Abishai had the greatest reputation. Very similar to Jashobeam, who slew 300 men. Abishai did something very similar. Verse 21, of the three, he was more honorable than the two. Yes. So now we're talking about character. And Abishai, the oldest, he certainly had better character than the second-born Joab. You'll see all of that later. For he was their captain. Howbeit, he attained not to the first three. Meaning, although he was a great warrior and had his own reputation for exploits, he was still of a lesser level in the army of David than the three, including the Benjamites that we talked about. Verse 22. Now here's another one. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many acts. Now, what tribe was he from? This guy was a Levite. That's because Jehoiada absolutely was in the political line that came out of the family of Aaron. Well, the family of the tribe of Levi, and specifically of the priest line. So very, very interesting that you've got this Levite warrior. And he's also now among the elite in David's army. What did this guy do? Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, so he came from a line of valiant warriors, who had done many acts, he slew two lion-like men of Moab. Also, he went down and slew a lion in a pit on a snowy day. How many of you would jump into a pit with a lion? This guy not only had a reputation for killing men at great odds, he even jumped into a pit and went one-on-one with a lion. I bet David really liked him. Remember, David, as a boy, had slain both a lion and a bear. He probably said, this is my kind of guy. Verse 23, and he, this Benaiah, he slew an Egyptian, a man of great stature. So probably not as big as a Goliath, but kind of in that same classification, a giant warrior who was Egyptian. He slew an Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits high. He was a giant. And in the Egyptian's hand was a spear like a weaver's beam. Isn't that the same description we had of Goliath, who had a spear that was so large nobody else could use it or wield it? And so here this Egyptian giant now is holding this spear. And he went down to him with a staff. This Benaiah, this Levite, went up basically to this Egyptian super warrior and plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. Now, what do you think about that? How mighty was this guy? He was one of the elites. Verse 24, these things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and had the name among the three mighties. So there's a whole cadre of these super warriors that have aligned themselves with David. Think about it from Saul's standpoint. What if you were the king of the nation? You've already had Samuel the prophet tell you God's taking away your throne and going to give it to someone else, and David. And then progressively over 8 to 10 years, you've got not just some of your soldiers, but the greatest, most renowned in your army are defecting from you and going over to your enemy. That was what was going on here. Verse 25, behold, he was honorable among the 30, but attained not to the first three. So this Benaiah, boy, he was a great warrior and very renowned, but he still was in a subcategory under the ones we've already talked about. And David set him over his guard. So in David's army, did he also have a guard for himself? In other words, your most elite guard that would protect David as the general in case they came under great threat. You want your strongest men kind of surrounding you. That's what this man, this Levite was, this Benaiah. Verse 26, also the valiant men of the armies were Asahel, the brother of Joab. There's the third son, the youngest son. Now, where was his name in the past? Remember the story of David sneaking down into Saul's camp in the middle of the night when they all slept, including Abner, and David took Saul's spear and his canteen again a second time to prove that he could have killed Saul and didn't do it? Ahishahel was the one who went to David when David said, "Who wants to go with me and sneak into Saul's camp in the middle of the night?" And Ahishahel said, "I'll go." All right, he's the youngest. He's also described as the fleetest of foot. Of the three brothers, he was the fastest, which is ultimately going to get him killed, by the way. That's going to be in the later story. David set him, also the valiant men of the armies were Asahel, the brother of Joab, Elhanan, the son of Dodo of Bethlehem. So I'll stop there. That's my short synopsis in order to give you a little bit of the biographies of some of these key men that were a part of this war band under David. 600 plus men. Now we're going to go back to 1 Samuel 29 and finish the very last verse, verse 11. But with that description of these mighty men of valor, do you not think that the Philistines knew about some of these characters? Do you understand better why the wise among the Philistine kings were like, "We've got these great Israelites, warriors in our midst, and we're supposed to trust these guys not to turn on us"? They were the wise ones to say, "Get them out of here. I don't care how mighty these guys are, we can't trust them. They're Israelite, they might go back to Saul at any moment in time. We don't want them in our ranks." These were the kind of caliber of men that were turned away and sent back to Ziklag. Verse 11, "So David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning to return into the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines went up to Jezreel." All right. So the table is set. Well, we're going to find in chapter 30 a whole side story of David and his army that's happening at the very same time. Now the Philistines are lining up and the battle with King Saul. There's two major things that are happening at the very same time. The first storyline is going to be David and his soldiers when they get back to their home base in Ziklag. There's a reason that David was not trusted by the four out of the five of the Philistine kings. God seems to have intervened to facilitate David's exclusion from the impending battle in the Valley of Jezreel. Because remember, David wanted to go. David was prevented from going, and that was God's intervention. David had his own scheme in mind. Now, he thought he was going to fight for Israel from the rear and destroy the Philistines and help Israel. That was his idea about how, you know, to serve God and to help Saul and the Israelites. Nice plan, except that wasn't God's will. So God intervened and he had to go home. He's off the table. All right. Next time in chapter 30, this side story affecting David and his family in Ziklag before we see the detail of Saul's final battle, which we'll cover in chapter 31 next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 29th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, June 20th, 2026. Thank you.